Matt Bubala here with you on 720 WGN. We're live in the Allstate Showcase Studio here in the Magnificent Mile. Matt Bubala at the mic. Jess Raines behind the glass and Roger Badish up in the newsroom. Hello, dear Roger.
Well, hello and a good morning to you, young man.
How are you, sir?
I'm doing pretty good.
Yeah?
Yeah, yourself?
I'm cold, Roger. It's cold outside.
Well, yeah, but you're inside. Is it
True.
Cold down there
Jess
again?
Jess has her full coat with furry hood on in the producer's booth.
Yikes.
It's a little chilly down here.
It does get cold down there.
Yeah. Yeah,
she should have come up and gotten my 40 below zero guaranteed winter parka thingy that I wear now.
She seems to have a pretty strong winter parka on right now. I think.
Well,
she's
I meant for
okay.
you. I know you're a he-man of a man.
No,
but.
I've got a winter coat down here. I try not to have it on as I do the show because that seems silly. And it's not quite that cold. And I knew it snowed today. And out in West Dundee, there were some snowflakes in the air.
But not like
but
down
I'm
here.
Down here and there's yeah. actual snow on the ground. I was yeah. surprised when I got down here.
Yeah, Rufus
the heck
didn't
happened
like
down
it.
Here today?
Yeah,
it came down hard for a little bit.
Well, in the morning, it came down the morning, and I'd say about 1 o'clock in the afternoon, it was pretty much done. I'm up on the northern part of the city, and about 1 o'clock, I looked out and I said, "That's not too bad."
But it stuck. I mean, there's good. Little
it was
bit.
Wet and cold. Yeah, in fact, now a lot of it is ice. It is frozen over. It'll be melted by tomorrow, but tomorrow afternoon. But it froze over, so everything's crunching underfoot now.
Yeah, and there's little piles in the corners, like they had to shovel a little bit today.
Sure.
So,
I like the guy on our block. He shoveled the main sidewalk, not the sidewalk from the building out to the main sidewalk, but he shoveled the main sidewalk and left the piles of snow at either end of what he shoveled. So he's blocking the sidewalk. What can't you not
so
just like make
that
little
that?
Curve
yeah.
and just put it on the grass? Come on. Rufus had trouble climbing over that
Aww.
Thing. Jeez, I'm telling you.
Poor Rufus.
Darn dog. He gets done with his business this afternoon, and I got the heavy jacket on. The gloves, I need a new pair because they don't really keep my hands
sure.
warm. And I got other things to do in the house. And he was real quick taking care of business and then decides to sniff his way all the way back.
Well, you know, Roger, that's like his greatest joy in life.
I know, but it was freezing out. He had his winter jacket on, too, but he's cold. He didn't have the hood on. He must have been freezing.
He's built for that. He's got fur all over his body.
He's a little skinny doggy. He's cold.
Well, if he's sniffing, he's not that cold.
I know. I couldn't believe it. I said, are we going? Are we going? Nope. And then he starts walking, and he tricks me. Okay, hey, we're walking back. Hey, nope. Pulls on me.
He's got to check out the neighborhood
he's
news, see what
check
the other
out
dogs have been doing.
Everything,
who's been
I
by?
Tell you. It was another, I don't know, half an hour before we got back. I was cold.
Well, that's good, though. He was happy.
Yeah, he was a happy little dog.
Made him happy. So there you go. So you've got that.
Yeah.
I was. I got to spend 2 days in New York City this week.
Hey, I love New York City.
Yeah. Stayed down in Times Square.
Mm.
It was very interesting. So I'm walking from Penn Station to a hotel I stayed at up in Times Square, about a 10 or 15 block walk.
Okay.
And I'm noticing it's been a year since I've been in New York City.
Okay.
And I'm noticing that every time we cross over a crosswalk. And what's crazy is it's a Wednesday at like 5 or 6 o'clock at night in New York City, walking from Penn Station up to Times Square. Every block I'm on, the wave of people walking against is as if 100,000 fans just got out of a sporting event and they're heading to the parking lot.
You were going the wrong way.
It doesn't matter which way you're going. There
oh,
are
really?
So many people.
Bad?
All it's just it's New York is just insane like that.
That's
it is
crazy.
So dense. I mean, here in Chicago, you could be in a crowd on a corner, on a sidewalk or whatever with 10 or 15, you know, Michigan Avenue on a Saturday afternoon, Christmas season. That's really nice. There's people or the Magnificent Mile Lights Parade. Right. Have you ever been down here for that? It's wall to wall people everywhere. Every corner of New York City, almost every moment seems like it is like our Magnificent Mile Lights Parade. There's that many people all the stinking time. It's crazy.
It's wild. I've been there a few times and walked at various times of the day or night and various times of the year. I've never noticed that large of a crowd. I've been in Times Square.
It's very invigorating, but it's also, after a while, like kind of like intimidating.
Well,
like thinking, man,
sure.
I wouldn't want to have the young kids down here. Like if you're not used to that.
Yeah.
Another thing I noticed, so we're walking, crossing all these streets, and first few streets we cross, as we're going through the crosswalk where you're getting into the sidewalk or coming out of it, mm-hmm. it seemed like we had to go through these turnstiles.
What?
There were these odd vinyl coverings over these very big, seemed like turnstiles. There was nothing to go through, but we had to go in between these things. And I was wondering, okay, are they setting something up? Is there an event coming up? What's going on? But block after block after block. Well, after a few blocks, there were no more vinyl coverings over them. And you were able to see that they were huge blocks of cement. Big, huge blocks of cement that basically divided the walkway into little lanes you had to cross through to keep going on the sidewalk.
That's the...
It was weird. I had never seen that before.
I'm thinking I know what it might be.
So it came into my head thinking,
yeah.
So they just had that terrorist attack
mm-hmm.
where the guy drove the truck up on the walkway and mowed down people. I thought,
yeah.
Oh my God, they've put these all out to make sure no car is going to get up on the sidewalk.
But it was only on the corners.
Well, it's where the car would jump up on.
Because cars are parked on the rest of the street, right?
Cars are parked or you're going up and down, and a corner, a turn, seems like where you would jump
yeah,
up onto
gotcha.
A sidewalk more
gotcha.
Easily.
Okay, yeah.
And I ended up asking the guy at the hotel about that, the bartender, actually, and who I happen to have a word with. And he said, no, it was not that recent. He thought there was an incident over the summer where a car, like a drugged out person, jumped a curb and killed somebody in Times Square. And he thought it was after that.
Mm.
Now, that's what he thought. But I'm wondering
yeah.
if it wasn't the most recent attack, I'm wondering if it was when it happened in England. It happened in England, right?
Yeah,
on the bridge
on the
towards
bridge.
Big Ben.
Mm-hmm.
I wonder if it was after one of those events that they said, you know what? This is where we have, because that Times Square is so heavily populated with people.
Hmm.
Now, I don't know when's the last time you were there, but right down in Times Square.
It's been a couple years.
All right. So right down in Times Square, there's a TKS booth or a Tix booth where you go to get tickets to any theater show and usually at a discount or maybe always at a discount. I don't remember. But it's on this like little island in Times Square. There's roads going one way and the other. You walk into the middle and there's this booth with bleachers on it where you can sit and wait. And but it's basically a big place to go see what shows are available, what can you get discounted tickets to, and go see a Broadway show.
Mm-hmm.
And that is on an island with traffic on both sides, at least last time I was there. Now they've blocked off one side of the street completely. Like it's not just like there's horses in front of it and you can't drive through, but it's
mm-hmm.
actually not a road anymore, and they've made it more of a promenade on at least one side of that.
Okay.
And the bartender said they are trying to make the whole Times Square area much more just pedestrian and not as much traffic, which has to be making
sure.
a mess of things, because there's already, I mean, you generally can outwalk your cab in New York City.
Yeah.
But I thought that was interesting too, that they're you know, maybe sort of trying to reduce the possibilities of incidents by restricting traffic access.
Well, New York Times says, you knew I was going to do this.
I had forgotten that Librarian Roger would be on the call.
Planners describe it as a turning point in the redesign of Times Square, a meeting around the end of 2012 when David Kelly, then the police department's assistant commissioner for counterterrorism, showed up with a copy of Al-Qaeda's English language magazine, which called on attackers to mow down pedestrians with pickup trucks.
That was in 2012?
That's when he had the...
Wow.
Yeah. Soon at Mr. Kelly's recommendation, pedestrian plazas that had replaced roadway along a five-block stretch of Broadway were guarded by three-foot-tall stainless steel cylindrical bollards. The thick posts stopped a sedan last week from plowing into dozens more pedestrians after a man high on PCP, this is what your guy was talking about, drove unimpeded through three blocks, through three blocks of city sidewalk, killing an 18-year-old woman, injuring 20 other people. Rampage brought to mind the terrorist attack last year in Nice, France, in which a cargo truck killed scores of people. Do you remember that one?
Yeah.
Bastille Day?
Yeah.
But the authorities in New York said that while the driver was trying to kill people, they had a history of mental illness and that they did not consider it a terrorist attack.
It's interesting is so at all those intersections, I saw the concrete blocks,
mm-hmm.
but right by the hotel, there were those cylinders. They look like, about 3 foot tall, as you said,
right?
Stainless steel, not real thick, sort of like when you go through the drive-thru
mm-hmm.
And instead of letting you scrape your car against the wall, they put up, like, usually it's yellow.
Sure.
A big kind of concrete hole that your car is going to hit instead of hitting the building. Look like a bunch of those, only 3 foot tall and a little bit thicker than what we normally see at the drive-through. But like stainless steel looking, kind of artistic, you know, looked nice. Didn't look like this is, you know, it didn't seem overbearing, like precautionary. It looked okay.
Well, this is
not
from
like these cement blocks.
May 23rd, and they did say, and the rest of the story, they were considering adding bollards on sidewalks around Times Square to match those around pedestrian plazas. Some elected officials and planners said the attack raises a more fundamental question. Why are cars still allowed to drive through the city's most clogged tourist attractions in the first place?
Yeah.
That's why what you're saying now about trying to get the cars off the Times Square area, make it into a pedestrian plaza.
And it definitely, they've done a little bit of that, because on one side by that Tix booth, they have gotten rid of cars. So, and there's still, you know, an insane amount of people, an insane amount of ads. If you've never been to Times Square in your life, it is absolutely, and a lot of people I know just like, oh, New York City, it's so dirty, it's overcrowded. Yes, it is all of those things. But it's a massive humanity, but it is cool. And if you don't like it, go there to reinforce that you don't like it, because you will love your home city of Chicago even more. Because our city, in comparison, is so clean, so spacious.
Yes.
So much more friendly.
They
all
don't have alleys there. They leave the garbage out on the
streets.
No,
the garbage is right down in the front, and the guy's got to come just swing by and grab it.
Yeah.
We have the great benefit of having our city been burned down once and had a chance to kind of rebuild everything.
Yeah. And those bollards, the barricades you were talking about, they're removable.
Oh yeah, the cement ones, you could tell, are just like, it's like a construction crew would come drop them out.
Right.
Could pick them up and take them. They're much thicker than, say, the parking spot. Well, not the parking spot, but like when there's construction on the highway and they put those cement blocks along to completely block off
the
lane.
Mm-hmm.
So
the dividers,
not as long as those. They're wider and shorter and stouter.
And there's a picture on this article.
I'm sure they can pick them up and move them.
There's a picture on this article showing that one. It kind of looks almost like a coffee table size. But they, in the rest of the story, they were saying that they were talking about what you described, that they're thinner and spaced widely enough to allow two people to pass through side by side, and those are removable, so fire trucks and billboard maintenance, because they got a lot of those in Times Square, can enter the pedestrian plazas and planted just under the surface of the street so as not to interfere with the subway system below. Benches also double as security barriers. Did you see a lot of benches around there?
I didn't see benches.
Okay.
But I didn't pay attention to it. But yeah, the silver things I'm sure can just be plucked out of the ground so the little cherry pickers can get through. Like by the hotel I was at, there was all sorts of construction going on, because every building is just a video wall down there. It's just an electric light orchestra of
neon gone. They've out neoned Vegas.
It's beautiful. Well, and you know what? It's not neon though. There is a little bit of neon, but mostly it's just video boards. Everything is a video board and live action ads and things like that. So it's not neon as much as just digital advertising, like crazy, like whole building sides.
Yeah.
Like
of all
six
the plays.
Story wrapped around ads for H&M or Dolce & Gabbana or whatever.
Yeah.
And yeah, a lot of digital billboards for Miss Saigon and Phantom of the Opera and all that stuff. Yeah.
I love Broadway. I've been there a couple of times. Went there first time in high school. Went there once on business, and then went there when our kids won their Emmy Awards. The awards program was in New York, downtown, and I brought the kids for. We were there a couple of days, and let them walk around Times Square. Showed them the Brill Building, where you know, all the hits from the 50s and 60s, all the rock and roll.
So
top
funny.
Hits were written.
I passed by the Brill Building, and it's under construction right now.
No.
Yeah, I don't know that it's not open, but like there's scaffolding in front, and it said Brill Building on like the thing. And I thought, oh, that's famous for some reason. I knew that name.
It's huge. Well, it's the place where, if you know the musical Beautiful, that's where she was to write all the hits. That's where Carole King worked.
I did not
writing. Oh, yeah. That's very famous. In fact, that's I think that's where, what's his name? The Crickets.
Crickets?
That's his band. That was his band. Buddy Holly. When he went down to New York for the record deal, he went to the Brill Building. That's where all the music was made. Even before the Brill Building, your original Broadway plays, musicals, George M. Cohan. This is where all the music
that's where the
was
writers made.
Yeah.
Well, a little later on in the show, we've got to get a break. We've got to get the news. We've got Kerry Walker coming up to talk about her book Fearless, which is an interesting way to look at saving and making money. She really wanted to move back to France. She had been an au pair in France for a year. Her desperate goal was to move back. She had $20,000 in college debt, and she wasn't making any money. She started stripping, and she made serious bank doing it. And so she's got some advice on life and finances. But later in the show, when we have some time, I do want to talk. I saw a movie while I was in New York City. There were no good plays playing for a matinee when there was time. So I went and saw a movie. And there's a movie out about Thurgood Marshall.
Oh, I want to see that
Just called Marshall.
Yeah.
And it is so good. We'll talk about that a little bit later on. Quick break. 227, 720, WGN. Bubala here with you, 720 WGN, trying to get a hold of Kerry Walker, our friend who's the author of the book Fearless, An Exotic Dancer's Guide to Personal and Professional Success. At 3 a.m., in about half an hour, we're going to speak with a reporter who's stationed in Rome right now. There was an interesting story we never got to last week, Roger. I don't think it's been talked about very much because there's been things going on in the world.
Really?
yes. Well, I don't know if you're aware, but it came out this week that men apparently always are masturbating in front of women without them wanting this. It's the craziest, weirdest thing
really?
To me. Well, it's what we keep hearing, isn't it?
Sarcasm is not my suit.
I don't understand. And that's I don't want to write it off as anything, but that's some weird mental illness thing, right?
Mm-hmm.
That excites you, that women who do not want to be there are somewhat forced to be there to watch you. That's crazy. I'm waiting for the, I don't know. I'm hearing in my head a couple of different things. One is, I'm waiting for the religious argument of, see, we told you masturbation was bad. You've gotten too progressive allowing people to be okay with masturbation. Now look at what they're doing. It's also a weird juxtaposition with the whole Roy Moore thing, the candidate for Senate in Alabama, right?
Mm-hmm.
Who it's come out, this is like 30, 40 years ago, that he, when he was like 34, was trying to date a 14-year-old, maybe some other underage girls at the time. It's so hard to talk about these things and figure out how to talk about these things because there's so many different like categories we have things going in. There's actual physical sexual assaults. Kevin Spacey's falling into that category. Brett Ratner's falling into that category. Harvey Weinstein's falling into that category. Harvey Weinstein is also and Brett Ratner, it appears, are in the just really creepy and like to do weird things in front of women and have this weird power trip. They're also getting some time in that category.
Mm-hmm.
And then we have Roy Moore, who's in a somewhat different category. I don't believe there's been an actual allegation of assault because it sounds like he was a very gentleman in his creepy way. That he would find these underage girls, ask their mothers if they could go out on dates with him, and then give them alcohol or get them into their underwear. But then when they freaked out or were creeped out by it, he would actually take them home. So that's a whole nother weird, crazy thing. And what's kind of interesting to me about that one is so many Republicans right away came out. This is true. He should not run. He should not be elected. He should drop off the ballot.
The state Republican Party has pulled funding.
And a lot of U.S. senators have come out against them, Republican U.S. senators, right? And that smacks to me of real opportunism. He was not the candidate anybody wanted. He's not the candidate Trump backed. He's not the candidate the establishment wanted. So it's very easy for them to distance themselves from him. If this had been somebody who has a lot of pull within the ranks and was the type of person they wanted leading the party, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, I think there'd be a lot more defense of this being a, quote, youthful indiscretion, as has been used in the past. Remember famously what, when it was revealed Newt Gingrich had an affair, right? Was it Newt in his 40s that they said that was a youthful indiscretion in his
40s? In his 40s.
So this is...
Well, the 40 of yesterday is now the 60 of today or something like that.
Excellent. So I got a lot of time. Well, not a lot of time, but I still got some time. So there's... That's, you know, it's the same thing with President Trump. The people that are retiring from the Senate are speaking out against him, but Democrats are staying rather quiet for the most part about President Trump. Certain things that he's doing, they'll speak out very strongly against. But for the most part, you don't hear a lot of, we're going to push for his impeachment. There has been some talk here and there. Did Luis Gutierrez?
Yeah, he called out for it, but it's mainly... It's mainly statements made in the heat of battle, so to speak, regarding other topics.
Yeah.
So congressmen speak up, Democratic congressmen speak up about certain issues that are going on, whether it be tax, whether it be Puerto Rico, whether it be whatever. And within that context, if the president's administration has not... reacted in the way they feel, the Democrats feel that they should have, suddenly part of the conversation comes up as impeachment.
Well, and I feel that with the Russian collusion, with whatever so far, we're not hearing about it because, and I've said this before, Democrats don't want him impeached.
Well, the Russian thing is not being talked about because they're leaving it in the hands of Mueller. They're not touching any of that until that
really
comes out.
If they felt he needed to get out of office.
Right.
If they felt that was in the best interests of the Democratic Party, they would be calling for his impeachment on a myriad of different reasons. You could say financial disclosures, Russian collusion, just what's come out so far. I mean, I think there's...
But you have to have hard evidence.
And you don't have to have hard evidence to call for it, to say he should be impeached, to say this should be happening. There are ways that they could really be pushing towards, we've got to find a way to get this guy impeached. I do believe that.
But you want them to take their one shot, and they would only have one shot at it,
of course. And
then fail.
Of course.
I mean, do you want them to do that now? One, a lot of them have said, a lot of the Democratic legislators have said, you know, we want to see what he's going to do. And they still have a tax plan to do battle over. They are still keeping their eye on the health care. More people signed up for it in the first week than ever before.
Right.
A lot of this stuff they're keeping their eyes on. I think the Democrats are being fairly judicious in this and are not trying to push the question at this time.
But why is that, Roger?
I can't get into their heads over that. I haven't been able to speculate.
We're on the radio. That's our job. Let's just speculate away wildly inaccurately.
No,
this is what we do.
You know, I'm only going to go with the facts of what I've seen and the words that I've heard from people.
Well, that's because you're the good newsman upstairs, and I'm the wild radio host who just says what he wants and gets in trouble later. And I will say this. Okay. The reason the Democrats are being, air quote, judicious.
Thank you.
Is because the feeling is, right now, he's imploding. Keep him where he is.
Right.
Pence would look presidential. We don't want Pence to be president. We want Trump and the cavalcade of clown cars to stay there to give us the best chance in the midterms. I mean, look at how that worked out last week. I mean, what a great night for Democrats. Possibly their greatest night since 8 years ago when Obama was elected. I mean, they turned the tide.
A lot
possibly.
Of inroads, sure.
We had a transgender woman beat the guy that pushed the bathroom bill, right?
Yeah.
I mean, that is an amazing turn of events, if you think about it.
Mm-hmm.
So a lot of things appeared to be shifting and going the right way for the Democratic side.
But that's just
and if they want that
election
to continue, it is, you're right, and it doesn't mean anything about midterms. It doesn't mean it, but it was in some pretty red places.
Yes, it was.
So that's
was. But this was the immediate reaction, if you will, the recoil reaction from the general election. This was the first chance the public has had a chance to speak their mind at the polling place, and I'm being the skeptical newsman that I am.
Sure.
I am saying this was a one-time thing. I need to see a series of events that support it.
Well,
or
yeah,
go against
we're not going to know. You're not going to really know anything until the midterms
next
year.
Exactly.
If the Republicans lose control of the Senate or the House, that would be a real, like, wow.
Yes, if it's that major of a turn at the midterms, then then you've got a groundswell.
Yeah,
and especially if it's in the right areas.
And it still doesn't mean that Trump wouldn't be reelected.
Well,
most often, the party in power, if you have the presidency, at least in my lifetime, it seemed, if you have the presidency and control of Congress. You get to that 2-year midterm, Clinton lost control, President Obama lost control.
Mm-hmm.
I think W might have, I can't remember, I don't know for sure. But traditionally, we as Americans don't like too much power in the hands of one party, and things tend to sway back the other way. It's
right.
It's our wonderful system of checks and balances that we seem as a culture to try to keep up on our own as well. Or maybe, I don't know, maybe the party in power gets comfortable and doesn't vote and the people annoyed by not being in power do. Whatever it is, it seems to work itself out. It doesn't mean it's going to necessarily in these midterms, but it will be interesting. I think so I do feel personally, and I know it's just my opinion, that the Democrats want President Trump to stay right where he is. They feel he shot himself in the foot a million times. He keeps finding ways to do it, and they want to ride that as long as they can.
And again, I'm going to bring in Mueller because that is a big part of what everyone's looking at in Washington right now.
Yeah.
The public may not be watching it, but Congress, all of Washington, D.C., is looking at this because if this turns into a Watergate, then we're going to see a massive upheaval in the leadership in Washington, D.C.
Right.
Now, which way will it fall? Will it fall back to the Republicans, but at a different level? Will it fall to the Democrats? You know, we're not sure which way this is going to fall because we don't have that information, which is rightly so. It's an investigation.
Sure.
One way or the other, the information will come out, the evidence will come out, and then we will see whether there will be pardons. Then we will see whether there will be criminal cases. We'll see.
Or there might be nothing at all.
Or there may be nothing. Exactly. And it may just be a lot of blowing in the wind.
But here's what I'm saying about that, Roger, is that while you're saying, well, there's an investigation, but he's holding back, they're this, they're that. Sure, they are doing that. But you're not going to hear Democrats right now say, this process needs to wrap up. He's got to put.
No, they're not saying that. The Republicans are.
Because they want it over.
Well, right.
Democrats don't.
Right, but
they're
being quiet about it. They're just letting it happen. That's what I'm saying.
They're sitting back.
Yeah.
But I'm saying they have reasons for that, and it's not just they're good Americans. It's because of the power of the party. I'm firmly believing the older I get, I guess I'm becoming less idealistic. Rod Blagojevich, Steve Bertrand was interviewing Rod Blagojevich over at my studio at Black Dog about 3 years ago.
This is
before he went away.
Yeah.
Oh, so I guess maybe it's longer than that. I don't know how long he's been in jail. But he had a book out right before he got sentenced or something, right? He had a book out. And afterwards when we were off air, we were talking to him about what he had done and how he said, this is all Trump, this is all ridiculous, and this is that.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, but isn't what you're doing, wasn't that illegal? I mean, you shouldn't be trading this or that or whatever. He said, you are so naive, young man. He did. And the truth is, Roger, while I do believe we have politicians who want the best for the American people, I believe that moreover, they believe that their party needs to have power so that they can do that good. And I do believe that if the Democratic Party has to sacrifice some things along the way, if some people are going to get deported. So let's say this is an interesting conundrum, right? Mm-hmm. What do you think would happen if we're in a room with Democratic leadership and we say, all right, so here's how this plays out. We've got enough that you could impeach Trump right now or get him to resign.
Okay.
But here's what's going to happen. He resigns and mm-hmm. Mike Pence becomes president.
Yeah, according to federal law.
And sure. Then he rallies the base. He works. He's a politician.
Mm-hmm.
He knows how to work with all these people that
he's
Trump
been in a long time.
Is not working with at all.
Sure.
And so he's going to be able to pass excessive LGBT legislation that's going to reverse a lot of the progression we've made over the last 8 years.
Okay.
And he's going to, all our polling, all our data shows he will get reelected and serve a term.
Okay.
Or we can leave Trump in office, drag this out further. 32,000 people are going to get deported and the middle class are going to get bad tax cuts and it's going to be bad here for 2 more years. However, all our data shows that he will lose the presidency and then you will take back over. What do you think they'd do?
Do I think that they would start voicing their desires to impeach him? I think
Trump stays president under that scenario.
Oh,
now, I know that this is a fantastical thing.
For the full term? For this full term?
If we were able to sit in a room with all mm-hmm. the Democratic leadership right now tonight mm-hmm. and say, listen, the P-tapes are real or whatever. Mm-hmm. We've got this smoking gun that's going to force him out of office, whether mm-hmm. it's a resignation or an impeachment. I don't know. But if we have enough right now, we could do this. Trump would have to leave. And if you sat with Democratic leadership and said, here's the scenario. If we force him out right now, Pence becomes president.
Mm-hmm.
Pence will rally all the people that he's worked with and all the people that like him as a politician, and he will pass a lot of legislation that you do not like as a party. He'll repeal LGBT protections. He'll repeal mm-hmm. civil rights protections. Tax cuts for the wealthy will pass. The middle class will be hurt. All of these things will happen if you impeach Trump. Or you don't impeach Trump, or you don't come out with this, whatever, mm-hmm. whatever, whatever. Mm-hmm. He stays in office, continues to be very divisive. We win the midterms, and then 2 years from now, we win the White House back. But in the meantime, all these people are going to get deported. The wall's going to start getting built.
Mm-hmm.
All these negative things are going to happen. But if you don't, it's six years of Pence versus 2 more years of Trump. What would the Democrats choose? And I'd say that they would sell out certain people in the party mm-hmm. and people that would suffer under 2 more years, and they would let him stay for right. what they believe the good of the party.
Interesting.
I believe it is party over people, I believe, for both of the parties. I mean, it clearly is.
It has become that.
It clearly is.
I think so. I honestly do. It's we identify ourselves now in this country more by what our party is than what our beliefs are necessarily. We still say, well, we believe in freedom of speech, we believe in this, we believe in that, but we more commonly nowadays say we're Republican or we're Democrat and all that entails. And sometimes that's a shifting picture.
Yeah.
Unfortunately, depending on which way the wind is blowing. Now, I'll throw something out because while you were talking, Librarian Roger
yes.
was looking up some information and re-familiarizing myself with my younger days, which are fleetingly becoming less memorable, and reading up on Nixon and Ford.
Mm-hmm.
And while the issues that we're dealing with today were not the issues, the social issues that we were dealing with back then, the same kind of scenario happened. But in that case, the building blocks of Nixon's presidency and the Watergate scenario just started falling some weak timber, and that forced his resignation.
Right.
I'm not so sure that is going to happen this time.
I don't think it's going to at all. I really don't think that.
Because we're not dealing with an evident crime. We're not dealing with people who were caught breaking in to.
Right.
You know what I'm saying? And then following the money.
Yeah.
Here, that was a singular event.
And we don't know that something else might not. We don't know what Mueller's finding. We don't know if there's some transaction. If there's some smoking gun.
Exactly.
We have no idea.
Right.
Maybe there will be. Maybe there won't be. As it is right now, there's a lot of smoke about what was going on. But and there might be people within his administration or his campaign that are going to, you know, there's already been a couple indictments. There'll be a lot, maybe a ton more. But I wouldn't be surprised, honestly, if Trump had no idea what the hell was going on with some of these people, that people who know what they're doing. He's a business guy, right? And he has ties with Russia that he seems to have denied because it's Russia and because it looks bad.
It was a business dealing.
Yeah. And because it looks bad. And if he denied things, I wouldn't be surprised because campaigning is all about appearances. And if it looks bad that he was whatever with Russia, of course, he's going to try to downplay it.
Yeah.
And being that he's a businessman and not a politician, I wouldn't be surprised if people on the inner circle were doing whatever they could to try to get him elected, knowing that his way is not the way it traditionally works. And so let's see what other help we can get.
Sure. And, but every political party does this.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
And they make no bones about it. Because when the dossier investigation came out and the comments about how the Republicans were doing it and then they dropped it and then when he was going to become and then Democrats picked up and they openly admitted it because this is what is done in politics now. You look for every edge you can find in order to put the opposing candidate down and build up your candidate.
Yeah. And the Republicans were doing it to their own guy.
Yeah.
Because they didn't want him to be their guy.
Right.
And then he became their guy.
Yeah.
And suddenly he's their guy.
Yeah.
But he's been the most not their guy in a long time. That's for sure. And they don't know what the hell to do with him. All right. We've got calls pouring in, but we've got a guest coming up right after the news. So let's take a quick break. 720 WGN. Matt Bubala here with you on 720 WGN. At 3:30, Ali Hashim will be on the phone with us from overseas talking about what's going on in Saudi Arabia, a corruption crackdown that forced about 200 people to be taken prisoner, sort of, for more questioning. This happened about a week ago, and one of the stories I was reading this week was that the Ritz-Carlton in Saudi Arabia, guests there, were quickly forced to gather their stuff and vacate the premises and get shuttled to other hotels because that became the prison for these 208 people in the crackdown. They gathered him up and brought him to the Ritz-Carlton.
Wow, those bars on the doors, I'm telling you.
So that's a hell of
really
a way.
Depressing.
I'll tell you, Raj, if I ever go down, okay, put me at the Ritz-Carlton, I'll answer your questions.
Well, you know how they're going to make it punishable. They're turning the hot water
service?
Off.
Oh,
no, they're turning the hot water off.
That would stink.
Just cold water.
The Ritz-Carlton would never put up with that. I'm quite sure.
And we're not doing the sheets every night, just every other night.
No turn-down service for you. No mints. That's it.
No mints.
All right. And
no minibar.
So at 3:30, Ali Hashim will be on the phone with us. At 4 a.m., Elise Harris, who's an author of Catholic Link, will talk to us about the Pope and the news that came out last week that he's looking at possibly allowing married priests. And so, sort of sounds like a trial run. We'll find out more about that. But right now, some of your calls are coming in. We're talking about President Trump and what would happen if there was a possibility of impeachment. I'm saying that the Democrats don't want him impeached. I know there's not enough evidence right now. I know there's not a real, like, should this be happening? But as we hear more about the investigation, as indictments come down, there's more and more talk about it. You wonder what would happen if. And I'm saying this is not going to ever happen quickly because the Democrats don't want him impeached. And here I will go further, Roger. I will say this. If something comes out of the investigation, the collusion investigation, wherever that leads. And as we know, and everybody should be well aware, I think, that while Robert Mueller is investigating Russian activities and meddling by Russia, and that's the scope of his investigation, let's not forget that Kenneth Starr's investigation started out, what the hell did it start out as? Was it a money thing? Was it a, it wasn't a sexual scandal investigation.
No, that came up as a side, as
it
a
came
sidebar.
Up during the investigation.
Right. And Mueller has even said that this investigation will go wherever it leads him.
So while Russia was the focus of it, mm-hmm. who knows what's going to come up or what's going to happen, that something might have happened, whatever, that could cause problems.
Right.
But here's what I will bet my bottom dollar on, Roger. If somehow this year there was something that came out mm-hmm. that invoked the idea of impeachment.
Right.
The impeachment would be led by the Republicans. Think about that. This right. is like a good movie script.
Right.
So the Republican guy's in office, but the Republicans don't really like the guy they've got in office. Mm-hmm. They got another guy sitting right underneath him who would be better and have a better chance of being reelected to office. So mm-hmm. they think, you know what? Kind of scandalous. Why don't we do this? We're going to save the party. We're going to do what's right for the American people. We're going to get on our high horse. We're going to impeach him. So they go and they start impeachment proceedings, and there's going to be the trial, just like President Clinton had, right? Mm-hmm. And the impeachment trial. And then the Democrats vote no. No impeachment, and he doesn't get impeached, and he stays.
Interesting.
Because they're going to say, we're protecting the Constitution, even though we think he's terrible for America, and he shouldn't be president, he should act right. We have to obey the rule of law, and the law says this and that, and the Democrats will be on their high horse, saying, we're protecting the Constitution, and you can only impeach under certain offenses, and he hasn't broken the blah, 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 blah.
Right.
And they'll act like they're high and mighty. The Republicans will act like they're high and mighty. Meanwhile, Trump stays president, and now he's ticked. And he takes a flamethrower, just like Al Pacino would have.
Yikes.
And, you know, Paul Ryan's in real trouble.
Yeah.
That type of thing. That's how I think it plays out.
Interesting.
How's that for a prediction?
Whew. Man, you're out there with a saw on that last branch.
Oh, that's where we like to be, Rod. Alex is dialed 312-981-7200. Hey, Alex, how are you this morning?
Pretty good. Yourself?
I'm good. What's going on?
I was listening to your program here and about the whole kind of political party games and them kind of leveraging for power. And we've been talking about the two main parties mainly. Just wondering what you guys had, what your opinions were on how the third parties are playing out on this, seeing that during this past election, the third parties such as Libertarian and Green Party swole in numbers and had some of their best year to date. How you see the power games playing out in their favor?
Well, I haven't really thought about that much, Alex, because I don't think about them much. Because to me, as much as I would love a third party to really have power in the U.S. and to get us away from this two-party, very corrupt system, I just see them right now as spoilers. There's never quite enough there to make a true difference. There's enough to maybe prevent Hillary from getting elected, that type of thing, and I don't know whether they did or not. I think if you wanted to vote for Hillary or if you really didn't want Trump, I guess there were people who protested with a third party vote, but I think those people might not have shown up then or not voted. If they weren't going to vote for Hillary or if they weren't going to vote for Trump, they weren't going to vote for him. And so I don't know how much that pushed things one way or another, but I just don't see them having enough power. And I don't know that there will be enough power. I guess one thing that could be interesting, and I don't know what kind of stamina Bernie Sanders has left, but there's enough Bernie people out there still who like to say Bernie would have won all the time, that maybe there's a push for a true third-party candidate, but I just don't see it happening. I think the I think it could happen on the Democratic side, but I just don't. I just see the pressure being so much towards whoever that was not to mount a true campaign like that, because if Bernie Sanders ran as an independent, then most likely we have a Republican president again through the next term because he would siphon off so many votes. It's still, even though Hillary won by 3 million in the popular vote, that's not so wide of a margin that a Democrat could withstand having a really strong third party candidate that takes away from them. Just like I do believe Ross Perot gave Bill Clinton the election over George H.W. Bush back in the day. Right. I do believe that that's what got Bill Clinton elected. And so the third party America is just not taken to the idea. America doesn't care enough to support a third party, quite honestly. I think we hate our two-party system, but we're too lazy not to put up with it.
Gotcha.
What do you think, Alex?
Coming from, I voted for Gary Johnson in 2012 in this past election. I'm now a dues-paying member to the Libertarian Party.
Okay.
I think the one thing I'm interested to see come this next election season, the primary election, is to see how many people actually go back to their original parties, or how many stay with their third parties after maybe being fed up with the constant back and forth, arguing with each other instead of arguing the topics.
Do you think more people will be, but with what's gone on over the last, or by the time we have the next election over these 4 years, do you think that will push more people towards a third party, or more people back to make sure the party they at least most align with gets back into power or maintains power?
I think that as far as that much goes, I think people for the most part are kind of tired of hearing either way. When Hillary Clinton's email scandal per se was being discussed all over the place, people were saying, I'm so tired of hearing about this. That's not the real news. We should be focused on this. And then people on the flip side of the coin that, this Russian, probe thing was kind of turning up. People were saying, why do they keep bringing this up? This isn't really the point. We should be focusing on this, that, the other. And coming from a small town, there's a lot of people that I know, a lot that are still steadfast in their original parties, but also a lot of other people that are saying that they're more interested in kind of playing these games with each other instead of actually trying to get to the bottom to help middle-class America for the better.
Yeah, I don't know. I don't know who's helping middle-class America. Of course, it's the Democrats who would tell you they most want to. Well, the Republicans would tell you, too. Everything you see about the tax plan looks like it does not help middle-class America as much as they want, or certainly helps the richest of the rich an awful lot. It's going to be interesting. So you're a libertarian, so no matter what, 3 years from now when we're voting again, you'll be voting the libertarian candidate, Alex?
I will be, so long as their platform stays consistent, they don't kind of sway from their policies, and they stay more forthright with American people. That's what I think. That's what really draws to me is they don't really try and bicker amongst the other parties, but they really try to get their point across to the American people, and they're pretty, I believe, transparent as far as what their platform stands for. So as long as everything stays consistent on that front, I plan on being libertarian for my life.
And are you okay with, not that you're okay with it, Alex, but, you know, people that say voted for, who was it, Jill Stein? Was Jill Stein was she the Libertarian, or was she the Green Party?
I think she was the Green.
Green Party. Gary Johnson was a Libertarian.
So if, say, Gary Johnson's running Libertarian, you like him, good ideas, and you're very supportive, but you know that there is no chance he's winning. I would imagine, because a lot of people are like, oh, you threw away your vote, you did this or that. And my guess is most people that vote for a candidate that they know in their hearts is not going to win the election, they feel, listen, I don't like either of those candidates. I know that one or this or that, I'm not going to be happy if either of them are there. And this is how I truly feel. So even though I'm going to take a stand with my vote, I want as many votes for this candidate as possible because I want to grow this. And I want people to stand up and be willing to turn away from this two-party system. Is that how you feel about it, knowing full well that most likely my candidate doesn't win? You're still okay with, that's okay, my vote is a vote for the idea of this type of candidate?
Oh, yeah, for sure. I mean, because you're never going to feel bad voting your conscience, I believe. And going back to what Gary Johnson said on his campaign trail, the only such thing as a wasted vote is voting for someone that you don't fully support or believe in. So I'd rather vote my morals and my conscience than whoever the lesser two evils or whoever the more appealing main party candidate is.
Yeah. Excellent. Alex, thank you so much for jumping on the phone. We appreciate it. You have a great weekend. 312-981-7200. If you want to jump in, do so now. Dan's on 720 WGN. Hey, Dan, good morning. How are you?
Good morning, guys. Thanks for taking my call.
Absolutely. What's going on?
Hey, I'm with Blago on this one. I think you're being a little naive.
All right, hold on, Dan. I want you to remember the moment that you called somebody and said, you know, I'm with Blago on this one.
Well, I just think that you're being a little naive, thinking that any politician's good for the will of the people. And just to prove my point, you know, I've never spoke with one person that doesn't want term limits. And why can't we institute term limits, even in our state? It's like, Why?
Because politicians aren't going to legislate themselves out of work, right?
Well, because they're not for the will of the people.
Yeah. Well, so. What do you think? If we had, Librarian,
yes.
Have we ever had a ballot initiative that would have been binding in Illinois on term limits?
My guess is the only way
that happens, because the legislature is never going to vote themselves to have term limits, most likely.
The only thing that's there have been ballot questions, they're referendums, but they are all non-binding. So while the will of the people, depending on what percentage of the people turn out to vote,
right,
and actually vote on that question, depending on where it is actually on the ballot, because sometimes certain voting districts don't allow certain issues on the ballot. So again, I'm qualifying this, but in the state of Illinois, there has never been, to my knowledge, and I've been around a little while, any ballot vote on a question that has ever been binding on the state legislature or on the governor to do whatever the majority of the people said they wanted them to do.
Do we have binding votes, public votes in Illinois? I know sometimes you'll hear about a vote and the people voted. So like in Kansas City, they just had a vote last week so that an airport could be built as long as it's not using tax money. And so if we had one in Illinois, how could we institute term limits? Would it have to be by change to the Illinois Constitution? Could it be by referendum?
Well, it would, any kind of change. That's why we run into this pension thing, because that's in the Constitution. That was changed, I think, during the last Constitutional Convention, where the state had to meet its obligations no matter what to fund these pensions to meet their obligation. That's the only way, my knowledge, that it can be done. I'm reading something here now. Results are not binding on the unit of government, subject to the general petition requirements found in the Illinois Election Code and the referendum petition requirements. Petitions must be signed by registered voters in the district. Authorizing statutes may limit a referendum to submission at a particular election. I'm reading just the highlight of this right now. There's a lot of ifs, ands, or buts on referendums here. And I'm just looking at an example from the Lake County clerk right now. And it doesn't look like anything is binding.
Yeah. So we don't, Dan, I don't know enough about Illinois law to know how we could get term limits. But it's interesting, you know, a texter just wrote, we have term limits. They're called elections. And that is...
That's true. So
that is true.
Yeah.
But you can also see, listen, it was great that Jefferson stepped down after his second term and cemented until it was passed into the Constitution that the presidency should be two terms.
Mm-hmm.
It would be bad if one party or one president. Listen, I would have voted for Obama again.
Mm-hmm.
There'd be a lot of America really unhappy that this guy got a third term. Let's face it.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe he'd get a fourth term. There'd be a lot of America really, really unhappy about that. And while it doesn't mean that the party has to switch over, I think it is good that new ideas and new whatever have to come in every 4 to 8 years and keep America moving and changing and evolving. And while we don't have that, and I'm sure if term limits were really pushed in Illinois, it'd be because of Mike Madigan, because he's been in control forever, and one person in one little area gets to control so much of the state, whether you approve or disapprove of what he's doing. That is interesting, because while maybe the whole state isn't thrilled with Mike Madigan, his little piece of Illinois... probably very happy with Mike Madigan because of all the power he's amassed. He's probably able to bring really good things to that area of the state, I would guess.
Well, I don't want to make assumptions here. It is my opinion that while Mike Madigan holds extreme sway in the legislature,
mm-hmm.
he is not the governor. The governor can propose. The governor can fight for what the governor wishes to become law in the state of Illinois or in any state.
Right.
And it is up to the governor to convince the legislature one way or the other. And unfortunately, more recently, politicians have been doing it with money, though I believe in the past that has also been surreptitiously reasons why people have voted, legislators have voted for certain things, because they've become riders on these bills in the past, where all of a sudden a certain percentage of money is going to a particular legislator's home district for this, that, or whatever. Politics is a game. Politics is something that is, in my opinion, is never going to be the purity that it originally was thought it would be.
Well, and let's probably say that politics was probably never as pure as we like to idealize it as, right?
I'm sure if we went back
to the founding fathers, there were dudes making side deals and making some cash,
right.
I would guess.
And that, I think, is why we have a small percentage of people wanting to go for third or fourth parties politically, but we also have the majority, in my opinion, even though this last election said it was in the minority, but the majority of Americans are so disenfranchised with politics and government. They still love their country, but they feel as though the political aspects of it have gone astray. Yeah. 45% of registered voters did not vote in the last general election. There is something wrong with that.
Yeah, well, as we said, America doesn't care as much as we like to think we do.
Yeah.
Texter says term limits were passed in Michigan and it has been a failure. We'll have to look more into that.
Yeah.
All right, thank you so much for calling in, Dan. We appreciate it. Have a great weekend, sir. We got to get to the news next. Then let's talk about what in the world is going on in Saudi Arabia. Speaking of corruption and a weird political system, things are going crazy in Saudi Arabia. We'll find out the latest on that after the news, which is next. It's the Matt Bubala Show on 720 WGN. Thank you for staying up even later with us. We're in the Allstate Showcase Studio in the historic Tribune Tower on the Magnificent Mile here in Chicago, where it is chilly and cold and there is snow on the ground. Joining us via Skype right now from the Middle East, from Tehran, is Ali Hashem. You can follow him on Twitter at AliHashem_TV. And hey, Ali, how are you this morning?
Good morning.
How are you? Ali, is it Hashem?
Hashem, that's right.
Hashem. How are you, sir? Thank you so much for jumping on with us. We do appreciate it.
My pleasure, sir.
So, Ali, let me ask you first about Saudi Arabia. We've heard the stories this week, and I read a story just online yesterday about the 200 or 208 people that have been detained for questioning, including some of the richest people in the country. This corruption crackdown, is this truly about corruption, or is it about restricting power and keeping power for the royal family?
Well, among those 200 and something who were arrested, there were several prominent princes who are thought to be threatening Mr. bin Salman, who's the Saudi crown prince, who might be seen as threat to Mr. bin Salman's ambitions to become the next king of Saudi Arabia. You know, he's a 33 years old prince who came directly from, you know, he was in the backstages, and then he appeared and became the defense minister after his father became the king. And right now he is the crown prince after his other cousin gave up or resigned, if it's right to say. His cousin resigned, and then he became the first crown prince. Today, what we are seeing in Saudi Arabia is was given a title as anti-corruption campaign, but mainly it's a campaign to solidify Mr. Mohammed bin Salman's position to become the next king. Now, all those who were potential candidates to become maybe crown prince or to have a big role in the next stage with respect to Saudi Arabia's future are sidelined, and he is the only strong person alongside with his brothers. And this is a new shift with respect to the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia, because in the past, it used to be the king, the sons of Abdulaziz, who was the founder of the kingdom. Yet after all the sons of Abdulaziz, the last one right now is King Salman, there is a need to change and go towards the grandsons, and you know, to find a way or a process, whereas the throne is exchanged through the grandsons. It's quite complicated and quite difficult. So the best thing I believe Mr. Bin Salman was thinking of is just shifting the throne from the family of Saud to his father's sons. So he will be the next king, and then maybe his brother will be the next crown prince. And so it's not anymore about Abdulaziz's sons, who's the founder, rather about Salman's sons, who is right now the king.
And do the founder's grandsons want to claim the throne? Were they trying to jockey for position to get the throne back to their line?
Well, this could have been a matter of question maybe after the death of King Salman, because when the king is going to die, or when he's going to give the throne to his son, Mohammed bin Salman, there will be a battle for who will be the crown prince, because Mohammed bin Salman will have to choose among many others and many other strong candidates to be his own crown prince. Certainly this choice will be through the what they call the commission of allegiance, or we call it in Arabic Hayat al-Bay'ah, which means there'll be a group of elderly who are going to choose the next crown prince. Yet Mohammed bin Salman will have a say in this. So whereas all those strong candidates aren't anymore in the picture, then he will have an easier choice to take, because he will be the man in control. So this is an issue for the future, and so it's not an issue for today. But another important thing is that all those billionaires of the kingdom were also arrested. We are talking about a number of people who own more than $100-200 billion. Al-Walid bin Talal, who's well-known in the West, who's well-known in the States, he's a big businessman, he's also a prince, was one of those arrested. Mr. Bin Laden, who is the brother of Osama Bin Laden, Al-Qaeda's notorious leader, was also among those arrested, because he's another billionaire in Saudi Arabia, and he's an owner of a very big construction company. The three most, the three heads and founders of the three Saudi networks, TV networks, were also arrested. One of them is Walid bin Talal, the second is Walid Ibrahim, and the third is Saleh al-Kamil. So everyone, almost everyone who is influential in the kingdom was arrested during the last week.
And so while this is aligning the prince's interests, what do you make of the billionaires being arrested? And, you know, I read that accounts have been frozen. What happens to them? Will this sort of be a question and release, and more of a, I'm taking control and you better mind what you're doing, or will they try to strip away their finances or decrease their power within the kingdom?
Well, what's happening right now is that all the companies are going to, this is what analysts are saying, most of this money is going to turn back to the Saudi government. So the Saudi government will have control over all these wealths. I mean, hundreds of billions of dollars. There are also people who had their money confiscated. Mr. Mohammed bin Naif, who was the previous crown prince, his money were also, his accounts were freezed. The sons of Prince Salman, who was Sultan, who was the previous crown prince also, he was before a crown prince, is the father of Bandar bin Sultan, who used to be the ambassador to the United States. And according to a report yesterday by David Hurst for the Middle East Eye, Bandar bin Sultan is among those who are arrested, yet his name did not appear in public. So all those people's money is being freezed, and the money are going to be transferred to the Saudi government because these people, according to the government, are corrupted. So, yes, the government is going to make use of this money, and this will be maybe the way the next king or today's crown prince will be able to pave his way smoothly and slowly towards the throne.
So while these people have been arrested, you believe that they will be stripped of their money, that these people who are maybe have up to $100 billion, that will be taken from them under the guise of corruption, whether it's truly something that is true or not?
Well, there is corruption, but it's not about the whole thing is not about corruption. The whole thing is about politics, because corruption is not only within those people. Corruption is something that is all over the royal family, and this is something well reported. But the issue is that there is, if we can call, a kind of a picky criteria. There is a criteria that is based on the crown prince's own ambitions and who poses threat on his future. This is how corruption is being used to pave his way.
Yeah. Well, so if you were living in Saudi Arabia and you had $1 billion, and maybe you still had the $1 billion, you weren't arrested, I would think that this would put a chill on the economy of Saudi Arabia, because if I were rich and owned a construction company, or I had money and it was liquid, I would get it out of Saudi Arabia right now. I would get it away from a place where it could be confiscated from me, or maybe get myself out of Saudi Arabia if the threat of this was lingering out there like it appears it is. I would imagine if they release any of these people and they get to keep their money, would they profess loyalty and stay, or would they get the heck out of Dodge and not take a chance on a ruler who decides that, no, you've got too much and you have the possibility of power, so I'm going to strip you of that?
Well, there is a very big challenge that's going to face the government of Saudi Arabia in the near future. Investors won't be really easy at putting their money in Saudi Arabia anymore, because such acts always threatens those capitals. So, and there is, according to some reports, before this campaign, there were, quite a big number of dollars, millions of dollars that were taken outside the country through private jets. And that's why the first thing that was done when they decided to arrest these princes and those billionaires was to close the airport. That's the where the private planes and the private jets are based, and not to allow any private jet to leave the country. So this is one of the measures to stop these money from getting out. Yet in the future, the big question will be, will other companies come back to Saudi Arabia and invest? Will Western companies have, the feeling of security to put their money inside the kingdom? This is a question that needs to be answered by the government of Saudi Arabia. And these concerns should be, in a way or another, comforted by certain measures that will secure that other capitals won't be seized or freezed.
Our President Trump tweeted support for the prince and says he knows what he's doing. Is there going to be a chilling effect on relations with other countries? And how does this affect Saudi Arabia's partnership or help with the general war on terror?
Well, with respect to the war on terror, there is a big, a question in this regard, because in Iraq, in Syria, there are accusations to Saudi Arabia, or at least to some in Saudi Arabia, of backing some of these terrorist groups. Now, these are not confirmed accusations, yet they do exist. Even Mr. Trump, during his own presidential campaign, he accused the Saudis directly of being behind Daesh, behind ISIS. So this is another issue. With respect to Mr. Trump's support of the kingdom and King Salman and his son, Mohammed bin Salman, this might be a green light to them to continue in this in their own policies with respect to Saudi Arabia inside, and also with respect to the region. And today, there is a very big problem in the region. There's a very big crisis with respect to the Lebanese prime minister, who was taken to Saudi Arabia, he was summoned to Saudi Arabia, and according to also reports, he was forced to resign. And this is unprecedented. This never happened in recent history. A prime minister of another sovereign country summoned to resign from the other country, from Saudi Arabia. He appeared on Saudi television, and he read the letter of resignation, and he is not allowed to come back to his country. The president of Lebanon is calling on the release of his prime minister. The French foreign minister met Mr. Hariri and said that Mr. Hariri is free to move, yet he's only free to move inside Saudi Arabia. This is just getting worse and worse. And the American, let me say, Mr. Trump's backing of Saudi Arabia is encouraging them to continue this way. Yesterday, mm-hmm. Mr. Tillerson's statement was quite good, because he was keen at stressing the importance of not going to more crises in the region to control the situation. Yet, on the other side, White House is giving the House of Saud more encouragement to continue. And many are afraid and concerned in the region that such moves might lead us to a regional war, and a regional war between the two main countries here, Iran and Saudi Arabia, might, no one knows how it would end.
Yeah. Let me, real quick, we were almost out of time here, Ali. With the changing of fuel and the nature of the way we're consuming energy in the world, with the increasing explosion of solar and wind and other forms of energy, how is that affecting mm-hmm. the kingdom? Oil prices have dropped pretty precipitously over the last year. Is there concern about the future of the kingdom because of oil?
There are several measures that were taken in the past to lessen the dependence on oil, yet still the kingdom depends around 80% on oil. Now, with respect to the prices and the prices deterioration this way, maybe the crisis is raising the prices once again. This is
right.
This is playing good for them for now. Yet on the long term, there is the question that you asked with respect to solar, with respect to other types of energies. This challenge isn't an easy challenge, especially that maybe all the numbers give us like 20 or 30 years more for the last reserves of oil that are in the kingdom, or even in Iran or the Persian Gulf countries. So the kingdom would have to make moves in this regard to change its economic dependency on other issues, maybe on technology, on agriculture, but not anymore on oil.
Yeah. Ali Hashem is a reporter in the Middle East. He's in Tehran right now, former Tehran bureau chief for the Arab News Network, Al Mayadeen, former reporter for Al Jazeera and the BBC. Fascinating discussion this morning. Thank you so much for jumping on with us, Ali.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me on the program.
Absolutely, sir. I hope we talk again. Just make sure you get his information. We'd love to check in with him from time to time and see what's going on in the Middle East. News is next on 720 WGN. Oh, well, hello. We're hoping to get our guest Elise Harris from Catholic Link on the phone here after the 4 a.m. news to talk about Pope Francis is considering allowing married men to become Catholic priests. Now, this is a small little baby step, but it might, if it works, pave the way for actually letting us have married Catholic priests here in the States at some point. I mean, they are desperate for priests. There's no doubt about it. There's a severe shortage. Something needs to be done. Should he take that step? We'll talk about that after we do this. This is Chicago's very own 720 WGN Chicago and WGNRadio.com. If you're an Amazon Echo user, just say play WGN Radio on TuneIn. News now at 4:01 in the morning. Here's Roger Badish. The Matt Bubala Show, 720 WGN. Good morning, everybody. Orion and Max coming up with the morning show in a little bit under an hour when we hit 5 o'clock. Right now joining us on the phone is Elise Harris. She is an American journalist from Denver, currently stationed in Rome. She works as the Rome correspondent for Catholic News Agency, and she joins us on the phone right now. Hey, Elise, how are you this morning?
I'm doing well. How are you?
Excellent. So you're stationed in Rome right now. You're from Denver, but you're in Rome. How long have you been in Rome?
I've been in Rome for about 4 years. So,
is that a pretty good gig to have, to be in Rome covering the church for the Catholic News Agency? I mean, you're from Denver, and I'm sure Denver is a wonderful place. I've been there many times. However, it's a lifetime goal for people to get to Rome someday. So to be there for 4 years, are you still like giddy to be in Rome, or is it, well, it's my job and I'm in Rome, it's where it's at?
You know, I think it's a little bit of everything. You know, I hadn't planned on coming to Rome, you know, and I, so when the opportunity arose, it was something of a surprise. And I think I was very, very happy to come here. You know, in terms of career-wise and professionally, it's been kind of a dream come true. But of course I miss Denver, the mountains, you know, and having easy access there.
Sure.
You know, the one thing I think people realize about Rome is it's pretty chaotic to live here. It's beautiful, but you know, it has its, unromantic side as well. But, we're all going to have to get used to.
Everything does, right? There's no panacea in the world. Everything has its realities. Okay, so thank you so much for jumping on the phone with us. We do appreciate it. I saw the story out last week, and we didn't get a chance to talk about it last week on our show. So there's a story out, and the headline, of course, is very like exciting. A Pope considering allowing married men as priests. It's a little more nuanced than that because this is a very specific issue that the church is trying to address. That in Brazil and in the Amazonian area, it sounds like for every 10,000 Catholics in the region out there, they only have one priest. Of course, there's a worldwide shortage of priests, but in some areas, much more desperate than others. So it's going to be so. The Pope hasn't necessarily come out and said, I want to allow married men to be priests, but he is allowing this to come up for discussion. And if I'm reading correctly, possibly for a vote by the bishops of the region as to whether they want to allow this. Is that basically what's going on?
Yeah, I think that's kind of a good summary. And I mean, I appreciate you saying that the issue is a little more nuanced than what, you know, some of the headlines would say. You know, and I think Pope Francis is somebody that's open to discussing a lot of things. I think he has a very open mind, and he says, if it's an issue, let's discuss it and let's see what the possible solutions are. And so I think this is something the bishops in the Amazonian area have come to him about, because you're right, that statistic is correct. There's probably about 10,000 Catholic faithful, you know, in the Amazonian area per one priest, which is a lot, you know, for one priest to handle. So I think they realize there's a problem there. And, the solution, I think he says, let's look at the different possibilities. And when this first came up in March, it came up because somebody asked the Pope about it in an interview. And he'd suggested that perhaps in certain cases with certain men in that certain area, but he did, you know, that it would be possible and he's open to discussing it. So nothing's happened yet. But he says, maybe we'll talk about it. But he did clarify in that same interview that, you know, blanket optional celibacy for the priesthood is not the right solution, and it's not necessarily going to happen on a universal level. So it would be within that very isolated situation.
But I imagine so. But that's how it starts out, right, Elise? I mean, the hope for a lot of people that wish that priests were allowed to be married would be that step opens other doors or the possibility if it works, if it helps alleviate the problems. And as we would imagine, the priest shortage continues to grow and grow. We have an aging population of priests. Priests are not retiring like they used to, forced back into saying Mass. I mean, I see it here at our Catholic churches all the time. We have an incredible shortage compared to when I was a young altar server 40 years ago. There's a big difference in who is available and how many people are becoming priests. So I imagine that among the very conservative old school Catholics in Rome, there would be concern about the opening of this store and whether what that would lead to. How has that discussion gone? Is there concern about the future if the Pope does allow this in this one particular region?
You know, I think there is concern. I think when the Pope says he's open to discussing something like this, you know, a lot of eyebrows are raised and a lot of people start to get nervous because there is a shortage of priests. But for example, in my local area in Denver, our seminaries are starting to fill up. You know, so you have a younger generation of priests that's starting to come in. A lot of younger men are starting to feel attracted to this way of life. And so I think that's been a sign of hope for the church in many ways. But when looking at how to deal with the shortage on a practical basis, I think little pockets here, it's going to be a lot easier, you know, to say maybe in this case or in this one isolated area, we could allow this. But for example, you have the church booming in Africa. You have the highest number of vocations right now, I think, is coming out of Africa. So you have a lot of missionaries that are coming, and that's been a source for other parishes around, you know, in the Western world, perhaps, as we've been able to benefit from the thriving church there. And so it's something, there's a whole balance, and it's a bigger question than just celibacy in this. And I think there are some people, you're right, who are perhaps afraid that that might happen. But even a couple months ago, the Pope had said, you know, well, let's study the female diaconate. But he also gave a very clear answer to no on the ordination of women. So I think we can expect, let's discuss this, but within these parameters. And it's really not going to go outside of, you know, the parameters that the Pope has already set.
Why do you think, Elise, that he said no so strongly to women ever becoming priests, but is willing to at least discuss the idea of married men becoming priests?
I think that's because it's a different issue in a sense. Like the women's ordination, I think, is a whole nother area of the church, and even theologically, that has a lot of different nuances there. And whereas for the ordination of men, like married men in some cases, the Catholic Church already makes exceptions. For example, if you have priests who are Anglican or another rite who convert to Catholicism. In some cases, the church will allow them to maintain their priestly right, but they already have a family. So if they already have that ordination, you know, in some cases, the church already does this, you know, in rare exceptions like that. And then these men that we're talking about are a very specific class of men called, you know, what the church called in Latin, viri probati. You know, it's the Latin term for just kind of like, it means proven men that are usually over 35 and already married, and they become permanent deacons in the church. If you see somebody, they don't have full faculties that the priest does, but they help out in certain ways. And so those are kind of the group of men that we're talking about. And so it would be allowing people who are perhaps already deacons or already on that path or have already been ordained to the diaconate in some ways, expanding their faculties in that sense. So it's something that is kind of already being, there are already exceptions in some ways. And so this would perhaps just be broadening those exceptions in certain areas.
So I wonder if some, and I'm just spitballing ideas, I guess, but I wonder if the way for the church in some ways to maintain the traditional priests don't marry, women aren't priests, is to sort of change mass possibly over the years. The deacons do, and certainly in my parish, do more and more and more than they ever have done to take more burden on, I think, because of the fewer priests. So if we allow more deacons and more deacons to have a little more responsibility within the church, that might be sort of the way for the church to alleviate some of the manpower shortages, but still maintain priests are celibate, priests aren't married, they're married to God, and be able to keep that tradition alive while still helping make sure that you can have Mass for the faithful.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's something, I think for the church all possible, they're open to looking at, you know, whatever solution might work, and perhaps, you know, it depends on, you know, I don't think anything specifically with the liturgy would change, you know, in Mass, but like the priest would always have to, I think, you know, be the ones to, like, you know, consecrate the Eucharist and everything. Like, deacons at this point can't, you know, they can help out with sacraments and stuff, but they can't say a full Mass. They can't consecrate, you know, the host for Mass. So that's something I think that will always perhaps be reserved to priests. But if you have practically, you know, the needs of sacraments for baptisms, you know, and different things. Like the deacons can help out with maybe some of the other overflow work that priests have to do in that sense, you know. And so I think, yeah, perhaps we could look at an increasing role of or an increasing presence or involvement on the part of deacons. So I think that's something that perhaps we could see. I don't know that they would ever change the liturgical rules, but I mean, I think it's absolutely something that's possible.
How is Pope Francis doing? Here in America, we're just not hearing a lot about a lot of other things right now because there's so many things going on in this country right now, whether it's in politics or currently in entertainment. But Pope Francis has been such a change from the previous pope, and whether he would agree with it or not, seems way more progressive and just a different leadership style. Is that jibing well with Rome? Are things working smoothly, or is there? You know, I remember when he first was elected and first things were coming out that he said, the media would there'd be big headlines, and that's how we do things now, right? You appreciated me saying nuance, because nowadays we read the headlines and we think we know what the story is because we don't read newspapers anymore. We read headlines on our phones or tablets. So when Pope Francis was saying certain things, there was a great outcry of he's saying this, he's saying that, and then people were saying he's, you know, settle down on what you think he's saying because you might not fully understand what he is saying. How are things working out with his papacy and the traditionalness of the Catholic Church?
You know, to keep on that word, you know, this is also a nuanced topic, you know, and I think that there are, you know, there's a saying here in Rome, sometimes they use around Rome, around the Vatican, like everything must change so that everything can stay the same. You know, so you have some people that say things need to change, but they actually really don't want change. You know, so you have some people that see what Francis is doing, and they're not necessarily in support of how he's restructuring things. So they, you know, it's a different model, and he's very much about decentralization, which is hard for some people in the Vatican to stomach, especially if they're the ones who have kind of had, you know, perhaps the bulk of authority in some things, to have that taken away in some areas or to change the structure of how, you know, inner workings of the church have functioned for years, you know, throughout John Paul II's pontificate. You know, I think a lot of people are perhaps startled or, you know, it's change is uncomfortable. So you do have some people that are not on board, you know, and I think that is, you know, it's going to be natural anytime you have a change or somebody coming in and doing things differently. So you do see some of that, but you also see a lot of people that are understanding what Francis is doing. And I think it's taken a few years for that to happen, for people to really understand his mentality and his approach. And I did an interview not too long ago. The Pope has a group of nine cardinal advisors that he meets with every few months to talk about kind of reform and different points of church governance. And so when I was talking to one of these guys, he told me that at first they weren't really sure how they felt about what the Pope was doing. But over time, they said his vision has become much more clear and it's become a lot more obvious to them. And in certain ways, what he's doing makes sense and it's the right path to take. I think you have both sides there. I think you have some people that are absolutely not on board, but you have others that are starting to realize also the wisdom of what he's doing and are in support of perhaps some of the changes, at least on an internal level, if we're talking about, you know, the reform that he's been trying to carry forward.
The Pope is 80 years old, but he seems very energetic. Has he been slowing down at all in his papacy?
No, and we feel it too. So I would say that I'm, you know, and aging myself here, you know, I'm not 30 yet, you know, I'm 29, you know, so I'm kind of like, I cannot keep up with him. So he's kind of, he's wearing all of us, you know, we call it the Vaticanisti out as well, you know, so he's somebody that certainly kept a very lively pace and a very active pace, you know, and I think one thing we have noticed is he's not taking as many international trips as he used to. And when he does, they're a lot shorter. Ah. And so that's something we're starting to see some of that. You know, I think he's realizing he can't keep the same pace he had or the same momentum at the beginning, just because, you know, he is 80 and it's a lot of work. So, I mean, and that's a practical way we perhaps see him taking a step back. But he certainly hasn't stopped traveling altogether. He's going to Myanmar and Bangladesh at the end of the month. And then he, on a day-to-day basis, there's just a lot going on. So in some ways, he's taking a step back, but in no way is he completely slowing down.
His predecessor, Pope Benedict, who was, in my mind, very different pope than Pope Francis has turned out to be, was the first to renounce the papacy since, like, I think it says 1294, I read. So he basically retired, and I imagine due to age, he's 90 years old now. Do you hear much about him? Is he doing okay? Is his health okay?
Yeah, you know, and this is in the news, there was a headline just even a couple weeks ago about Benedict, you know, and everybody thought he had passed away or was sick or ailing or something. And I mean, he's old. He's 90, as you mentioned. So I think there are natural signs of age, but he's in good health overall. He's old. He can't really walk as well anymore. You know, he uses a walker when he walks, and he still receives people, though. I think it's common for him to receive people in the afternoons, not every day, but, you know, if there's somebody who requests, you know, and has a special intention they would like to come talk to him about or just meet him, he still receives people. And he generally, yeah, he's very clear in his mind. He follows even political situations very well, you know, and I had the honor to meet him in March. A few of my colleagues and I, you know, had an opportunity. There was a special anniversary for our company, and we'd asked for an audience, and we got that. And he was, he received about five of us, and he was very clear-minded, and he was asking about current situations, you know. And so he has the natural signs of age. Perhaps he can't hear as well, he can't see as well, you know, but it's not, you know, in no way is he on the deathbed, shall we say.
Well, that's good to hear. Elise Harris is a writer for Catholic Link. She is stationed in Rome right now. Are you in Rome for the foreseeable future? Is this just a continuing assignment until you decide to do something else with your career?
Yep. For right now, this is indefinite. So I'm happy where I'm at. And for now, this is where I'm at.
Excellent. Well, enjoy the rest of your weekend. Thank you so much for jumping on. I hope we can chat again.
Absolutely, me as well. Thank you so much.
All right, thank you. Elise Harris from Catholic Link. News coming up on 720 WGN. Play ball, celebrate the Cubs with team memorabilia, exclusive books, and so much more. Visit ChicagoTribuneStore.com today. Speaking of the Cubs, Chris Bryant had a very interesting Twitter exchange yesterday. I will talk about that and tell you what happened and how he might have misstepped a little bit after we check the news. Headlines now, there's Roger Badish. Roger, I think you might have missed one of the most important stories I've seen out there.
Holy moly, Batman.
May I jump in and add one for you?
Please jump.
Dateline, Kansas City, Missouri.
Wait a minute. Let me give it an appropriate. Ready?
Please do. A police interrogation. Well, I don't think you keep that up the whole time.
Oh, sorry. Okay. I was losing my breath there.
I thought, boy, Roger's not going to make it through this whole thing. It's a little long. A police interrogation of a Kansas City man charged with drug and gun offenses ended prematurely.
Uh-oh.
When an investigator was driven from the room by the suspect's excessive flatulence.
I was going to say that.
A detective reported that when asked for his address, 24-year-old Sean Sykes Jr., quote, leaned to one side of his chair and released a loud fart before answering.
The Kansas just emphasizing it.
The Kansas City, yeah, you know, it's really bad when you got to lean. You would think you're being arrested. You want to have some decorum. You want to keep the officers somewhat, you know, on your side or impartial.
You don't want to let
you
on.
You tighten up and you go as easy as you can.
Yeah.
But say, you know what? I'm already here. Here we go. Oh. The Kansas City Star reports that Sykes, quote, continued to be flatulent, and the detective was forced to quickly end the interview. Sykes appeared in court Monday, charged with being a felon in possession of three firearms and possession with intent to sell cocaine. So he had bigger problems.
Too.
Yeah, he had bigger problems. Yeah. The charges stem from police traffic stops this month and in September in KC, Missouri. Federal Public Defender's Office hasn't responded to an Associated Press email seeking comment on Friday.
Yeah, he had another deadly weapon.
And it wasn't even silenced.
No.
No silencer on that one.
But he was loaded, I tell you.
Roger.
Don't get me started.
Well, you're already started.
Yeah, I know.
All right. Quick break, and then what did Chris Bryant do to get himself, I don't know if he didn't get himself in hot water, but he almost took, I thought, a Twitter misstep. Twitter is very interesting. You make a comment on Twitter, and if you weren't thinking it through thoroughly, people are there very quickly to set you straight.
Oh, yeah.
Chris Bryant got set straight by a few just yesterday. We'll talk about that next, 720 WGN.
I'm Ron Wexler with the Wexler Real Estate Group. There's two ways to get a home sold. One is passive, put a sign in the yard and an ad on the internet. The other one is active, where we go out every single day and search the market to find the perfect buyer for your home. Our active marketing system includes social media, outbound sales calls, inside sales agents, direct mail, radio advertising, and extensive internet marketing. We have hundreds of buyers actively looking for homes right now, including cash investors who can close on a home in about 10 days. My partner Tammy Northcutt and the entire team at the Wexler Group are with you every step of the way, looking out for your best interests. We've been serving Chicagoland for 35 years, so if you want to sell your home faster, for more money, and with less headaches, call the Wexler Group at Keller Williams Preferred Realty today at 1-866-699-6333 or online at thewexlergroup.com.
It's a Citgo hockey game night experience. Check in to score, and you can do it by registering on the Club Citgo app. Download Club Citgo from the App Store and check in daily at participating locations for your chance to win four Chicago hockey tickets and more. The contest runs from October 25th to December 20th, so download the Club Citgo app today. Check in to score. Four tickets to a Chicago hockey game and more. Visit clubcitgo.com for complete details.
Oh, boy!
What a goal!
Take a packed weekend of Chicago sports anywhere you go with WGN Radio.
The Cardiac Cast in triple overtime.
This afternoon on AM 1160, the Northwestern Wildcats welcome the Boilermakers of Purdue to Ryan Field. Dave and Ted have your pregame at 5:30. And on AM 720,
the Chicago Blackhawks, Carolina Hurricanes.
I'm John Weideman. Troy Murray and I will have the puck drop for you at 6 o'clock.
Plus, tomorrow the boys are back.
Now we're going to do things right.
That's it. I'm done.
This is what you're going to get, folks.
The best Bears postgame. The Chevy Hemp and OB show with Kaz. At 3 o'clock after Bears Packers. Chicago sports and the Chicago sports conversation. All weekend on 720 WGN.
Matt Bubala with you, 720 WGN. Feels like the first time. Very good bump to segue into a Chris Bryant honeymoon story, I guess. 312-981-7200. Matt Bubala here with you for 20 more minutes. Raj, guess what I just heard?
Uh-oh.
The morning show coming up in 20 minutes, hosted this morning by Max Armstrong.
Yep.
Live from where?
Where you just read the story from.
From Kansas City.
Uh-oh.
He's on the case.
He's sniffing out the... Never mind.
Roger. Jeez, you are something else. I appreciate that you are the immature one on the show.
Oh God, please! I've got the members card number one.
I hope all my grade school teachers are listening and realizing for once, Matt Bubala is not the most immature person in the room. My years at St. Thomas More—they never would have guessed that's how it would turn out.
I just beat you to it. That's all. You wanted to. You know you wanted to.
You go low, I go high, Raj. I follow the Michelle Obama rule.
Okay.
All right, so Chris Bryant tweeted today, and I think I saw that. I think Cap retweeted it or something. I don't know how I saw it. I don't follow Chris on Twitter. But Chris Bryant tweets, finally getting the chance to take our honeymoon. But we missed our at American Air, so he tags American Airlines, American Air check-in by 30 seconds. 30. Where's the team sponsor love? American Airlines, official airline partner of the Chicago Cubs. So Chris misses his flight with his lovely bride. And instead of saying, boy, aren't I an idiot showing up late to the airport when kind of everybody in the world knows how this works, get there early, it could be a big mess. TSA, everything else sometimes screwed up. You get there 2 hours early, you check your bags, and you wait and have a drink in the bar, Chris, or a soda, whatever. You don't. If I missed it by 30 seconds, that's really on me, not on American Airlines, to say, no, Chris, we know it's you. We'll open the door back up and let you on. It's just not how it works. So Chris threw that out there, and American Airlines replied, oh, no, Chris, please direct message us your record locator so we can take a look. Our airport team will help you too, though. So American Airlines right away, of course, you know, big guy pulled out his big stick and they come running along. Of course, they want to make things better for Chris Bryant.
Yeah, but
now
still.
United Airlines should have jumped in and said, Chris, your hometown Chicago airline will take care of you. Walk on over. We'll put you on a plane right away. But they didn't. God, where were the so now there have been so many replies that have maybe pushed this around, but there were some great ones right away.
Oh, on his Twitter.
Yeah. Wait, I
missed that one. I follow all day long.
So somebody on Twitter replies, or you can just show up on time like the rest of us and not ask for special treatment.
Oh, hello. Yo.
Somebody else tweeted back at that, but KB isn't the rest of us. If you were him, would you honestly show up and sit at the gate 60 minutes early? And then they hashtagged 60-minute autograph session. Well, then go in the American Air Club or something. Buy the special thing. You can avoid people at the airport,
too. I wonder if he has a special...
He probably doesn't because he flies charter all the time with the Cubs. It's not like they're flying commercial. So yeah, maybe he's a little unaware of how it all works, but I'm guessing he's flown on planes.
The other half of the year, he's flying all over the place with his family, I'm sure.
The other half of the year, he's probably in Vegas concentrating on his work.
Yeah.
Getting better.
He's from Vegas. Yeah.
He is, so he probably doesn't fly around all the time.
Well, all right. Well.
Let's see, what else? I mean, of course, there's a million.
Were there any worse than that one that you read?
Tell the Ricketts to send you their private jet. Maybe leave earlier, champ, like the rest of us.
God. Wow.
No, I would. I think he opened himself up for that.
Yeah.
This was a misstep by Chris Bryant. This person writes, if they held it for everyone who was running, quote, just 30 seconds late, they'd never get the plane off the ground. On non-charter, non-private flights, you're no more special than any other traveler. Everyone else showed up on time and made the flight. Bam! That's from Jay Davis.
I'll go along with it.
Other guy wrote again, would you really show up 60 minutes early if you were him? The guy says, the options are politely decline or sign autograph. Disguises. Missing flights because it's too late to check in or charter a private plane. Celebrity comes with good and bad. Somebody writes, were you flying out of St. Louis? I mean, you're Chris freaking Bryant.
Hello. Wow. So what, did he ever reply back to anyone or anything? Or did he correct
I never
it,
saw
or?
Him. Oh, you know what? So he tweeted again later in the day.
Uh-huh.
He said, he writes, quote, if you're not 15 minutes early, you're late. Dad. And then he writes, life lesson, always listen to dad.
Oh, there you go.
So that was smart of him to come back and admit
that
he... So
he put it on him, yeah.
The thing is, I mean, I know the easiest way to get a hold of anybody now is to tweet something like that at American Airlines. And I'm sure they rushed to help him, and I bet him and his bride run first class on the next flight. But, and they probably got to be in the American Club until then and all that good stuff.
Mm-hmm.
But he could have called, I'm sure he's got a number to a Cubs PR guy who knows somebody at American who could have tried to help him out. But the fact is, once that plane left.
Yeah, it's gone.
And you're kind of stuck.
Gone, yeah.
And, you know, you got to show up early. And Chris Bryant is so beloved by Cubs fans.
Yeah.
And such a good guy and such a class act and all that stuff. But when you write, hey, American Air, where's the team sponsor love? I was 30 seconds late.
Yeah.
That just reeks of let them eat cake, doesn't it? I mean, it's like, come on, dude, show up for your flight. Yeah. You already make way more than the rest of us ever will. You get to play baseball for a living. You're leading the life. Don't whine because you showed up late for your flight. That's, you know, that was a mistake.
I bet he was just having an awful, terrible
As we
day.
All are, Raj.
Oh, come on.
We all have awful, terrible times getting to the air. Listen, I had to go with Steve Dale once to New York. A couple years ago, what does Matt Bubala do? Matt Bubala shows up late. The flight is in C, which means you got to go underneath, run across underneath the runways, and get back up on the other side.
What?
And when I come up the escalator on the other side, guess what?
plane's gone.
Door was already closed.
Oh.
And I got Steve Dale texting me, are you on the plane?
And he was on the plane.
He was on the plane.
Well, wait a minute. When you book your flights with Steve Dale, don't you book seats together?
No.
Or is he riding first class and you're back in
steerage?
He's
always up in first class and I'm with the luggage.
Oh, there you go.
Yeah, I got like a chicken on my lap the whole flight. That's how it works.
At least it's not the guy. Never mind.
Yeah. Yeah, I don't get the Steve Dale treatment. I got to push first and then jump on as it's rolling.
Why is he texting you?
Once they throw it into gear, I get to jump in and then they close the door. 720 WGN. 3-2-9-8-1-7-2-0-0. Max coming up from KC in just a couple of minutes. Coming up next weekend, I think it is, on the show, we've got the author of a book called, I think it's called Extinction. And it's a riveting story of a firefight over in Afghanistan. From the U.S. military in the kind of the lore of Black Hawk Down and things like that. We'll have an author of that book coming up. And I want to get to a story next week. Bob Lutz, who used to be one of the heads of General Motors and many of the major auto players in the world, says it is the end of the automobile as we know it. And he predicts a future where we will not drive cars. We will have automated pods, car pods, that just pick you up, get into automated transit systems, which would be wonderful in that you don't have to worry about doing the driving, things like that. You can get other work done while you're in your car. But all the fun and the freedom of automobiles, he says, is completely going away. We'll get to that next week. Max coming up next here on 720 WGN.